Hi, I'm Linda. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Is that loud enough?
Yeah.
Okay. My sobriety date is August 14th, 1996, and my hope group is the Midtown Group, and I have a sponsor, Alma V, from Little Washington, Virginia. And I've never spoken this long before, so hopefully I will do okay. And thanks so much for asking me to come out. It's a real honor to be invited anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's wonderful to be invited anywhere, you know. And just to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I always start out and say that, you know, I'm an alcoholic, which means that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. It means that I have a physical allergy. It's a twofold disease, a physical allergy and a spiritual malady. And I've warped my mind into such an obsession that when I start drinking, I cannot stop. And that when I start drinking, that drink changes the landscape of my entire world, you know. Suddenly, what is an unbearable, a seemingly unbearable existence becomes bearable. Not only bearable, but beautiful and delightful. At least that's how it was for a long time when I started drinking. And when I was growing up, I felt like I wasn't right from the very beginning. And I can remember being 4 years old and standing on the porch at my parents' house in Pennsylvania and thinking to myself, is this my life? Because if this is my life, I think I need to die. And I don't think everyone else was thinking like that in my preschool class, you know. They were thinking like, God, I hope my mom braids my hair today. That'll be really fun. And I just always felt a little on the outside, a little like I couldn't connect with the other kids, and that kind of lasted my whole life. And there was a lot going on in my house, and there was a lot of physical, mental, sexual abuse going on in my house. And the good news for me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was to find out that none of that made me an alcoholic. And I'm not an alcoholic because of anything my parents did, or because of anything that I encountered in my lifetime. I'm an alcoholic because of the reasons I stated at the beginning of my talk, is that I have an illness, a twofold illness, an allergy of the body and a mental obsession. And that is the best news that I could have ever heard, because that makes me not a victim, but it makes me have the power to take responsibility for my own recovery. You know, and when I came in, they said, "What your life, you know, my life is my fault and my recovery is my responsibility." Now, I do believe that I was affected by all the things going on in my house, and they definitely were things I had to work out, and a lot of them were things I had to deal with in the sixth and seventh step. So for me, that's how I held it, because they got down to the causes and conditions of my character defects, which are all my own, and not the fault of anyone else. And as I was growing up, I was a sick little kid, and when you're sick, there's a lot of things around being sick. You don't have to do a lot of things that you don't want to do, and you get a lot of sympathy. And you also get some drugs, a little bit of drugs. And this is an AA meeting, and I consider myself an alcoholic. But a while before I drank, most of what I was taking was prescribed to me. And I thought that it was okay because it was prescribed to me. I had a very old-fashioned doctor who thought that you could get codeine for anything. Sunburn, anything. You know, just say, chill out. You know, that's what you tell me. And as a result of that, I had all these weird feelings. You know, I'm all about my feelings, and I didn't relate to anybody. I didn't fit in, and I would be sick. And it became a line for me, just like it talked about in Acceptance is the Answer, which used to be Dr. Alcoholic Addict, in the big book, where I could no longer tell the truth from the false. I could no longer tell if I was really sick or if I was getting myself sick, because I needed those things. And I needed the whole ritual around it. And I didn't drink when I was a kid living in my parents' house. I grew up in a really Christian home. And in that home, you did not do drugs. You did not smoke. You did not drink. You did not do anything. You didn't see R-rated movies. You didn't do anything. And I was really afraid of my mother. So, you know, but I thought I was okay doing what I was doing with the sick thing because I'm sick. And the doctors are saying I'm sick. And I also, you know, dabbled in some other things in eating and things like that. But so I just had this mentality. I have what I consider the checkout mentality, and I believe that I was waiting for a drink. I was just waiting for a drink. And when I went away to college, I really hadn't had any experience with drinking. I had drank once or twice in my parents' house, and my uncle was an alcoholic, and they had a big talk about him, and there was other people in my family that had problems with alcohol, and there was a lot of hush-hush about that. And I went to a Christian college, and it was really very structured, you know, no guys or girls together in any dormitories, no drinking, you could get expelled, you know. And I had one episode. The first time I drank, I woke up the next day and I had no idea what happened. And I was on the verge of being expelled. My roommate wasn't speaking to me because she had had to clean up my mess from the night before. I mean, it was just like the first major time I ever drank, you know, the first time on my own, and it was like that. And I don't know why, at that moment, I didn't chase that feeling or remember how it felt. I don't even remember how it felt before I got to the blackout part. There wasn't even any good memory of that night. And all I remembered was, I have to get out of trouble. And I had all these cards I wanted to play. And I just went in there and I told the truth to my RA, and she was like, you're really lucky we're not going to make an example of you. And I was like, okay. And she didn't. And I didn't drink the rest of the time I was there. But I was very depressed, and I wasn't leaving the house. I wasn't leaving my dormitory. I wasn't going to class. Eventually, I had to drop out of college, which was the beginning of multiple colleges that I dropped out of and traveling across the country. And I really believe that was part of the alcoholism, the ism that was going on for me, until eventually I wound up, I was doing an internship in D.C. Through my college, and I was doing an internship called American Studies. It's where you intern with a government agency and you take classes, and I wound up on the top of a building in D.C., and I was going to jump off of it. And someone suggested that I maybe get some help for how I was feeling. Because I still had all of this. I had that feeling of restless, irritable, and discontented all the time. And when I came to AA, and someone read those words to me out of the big book, I felt like, oh my gosh, I've never heard those words before. I mean, I felt like I'd been giving new vocabulary words because it fit exactly how I was feeling inside. And, but right now, at this point, when I entered a mental hospital, and, all the conversation that I could have around how I was upset was self-pity, constant self-centeredness about how I was feeling and how bad I was feeling and how I wasn't good enough or how I didn't fit in and all this around myself. And I went in, and I do believe that the good thing that this place did for me was probably arrest any harm that I could have done to myself. Other than that, I'm not so sure that I got anything else out of it. But I stayed there for a month inpatient, and then I was in and out for 2 other months. But I left this place because all they did was tell me about how crazy my family was and how this and that and all kinds of stuff. And maybe in the long run that might have been beneficial. I don't even know. But all I came out of there with was a bunch of pills for anxiety, and that said, take as needed, and of course, why not? You always need them. You're always anxious. And so what I came out of there with was this idea that if I went to therapy every week, somehow my life was going to change. I had no thought. There was nothing in my mind that said, but I have to do more than just show up and talk about my feelings or talk about how awful I feel every week. There was no concept to me, and it might have been said to me, but I did not hear it, that I might actually have to take some actions that were different from how I was living or any responsibility for my behavior. And this victim mentality that I was in, I just kept being told how brave I was or how courageous I was and how I was going to, thank God you found out, But I was still living exactly how I had been living all my life, in this self-pity, depressed, gosh, I wish something could just come fix me kind of attitude. And I became a nanny, because I really wasn't qualified to do anything else, and I probably was not qualified to take care of anyone's precious children either. But in order to stay in the D.C. area, I became a nanny, and I was living with this family. And I remember very distinctly one day just standing in their foyer, and what it occurred to me, I'm 21 years old. I can drink now. And it was like a time clock went off inside of me. It was like, it's time to start drinking. And I left the house that night. I put on a short skirt and some high heels. And I had $3 in my pocket. And I left that night. I left the house. And I didn't come back till the next day. I drank all night. And I left with whoever promised to have the most amount of alcohol at their house. And that is what I did every single night for probably the next year and a half. I mean, until I got a steady boyfriend. But that was my thing. It was like every night, $3 all night. I'd come home at 5 in the morning. I'd sleep for an hour. I'd get up, and I'd come home, and I'd put this green mud mask all over my face. I would go to sleep, and I'd get up, and I'd walk the kids to this bus stop, like 3 blocks away, with this green mud mask on my face, in this hungover, in sweats, these awful pajamas, and then the kids they would go to school. I would sleep all day, and I may get grocery shopping done. I may not. I would get laundry done. I would do the basic minimum things I had to do. But otherwise, I wouldn't drink during the day. But when the kids would come home, I'd put them in front of the television set. And I would just lay there because I would be too hungover from all the drinking I did the night before. And so my boss would come home. I'd be in the same clothes that she left me in. And I'd have this green tinge all around the edge of my face because I couldn't have scrubbed the whole thing off completely as a mud mask. And I didn't understand why they wouldn't give me a raise, And I was so delusional. I thought I was being taken advantage of because they would ask me to clean other things or they would ask me to you know, she would have a dinner party on like a Saturday night, and she'd leave everything out for me to clean up on a Monday. And I would think, who does she think I am? You know, like, what does she think? You think I have nothing else to do? Like, I didn't have anything else to do. And so it became a process for me of becoming more degrading and more degrading in my actions. And eventually they moved away, and they actually asked me to move with them to New York. It was the most, looking back, it is one of the most astounding things I've ever heard of in my life. And at this time, and, you know, during this time, I had, I just was causing fires. I was dating a guy who was running for office in Virginia, and I thought so poorly of myself. I would stand in the corner and drink until I was smart enough to associate with people. And once I started talking, until the lieutenant governor of Virginia was asking my boyfriend about my drinking, things didn't go well for his campaign, and I had a large part to do with that. And that was on my 8-step list later on. But I eventually got hooked up with some people in Washington, D.C. that were on a really fast track. And this is when my alcoholism really took off, because I wasn't working. I had time off when this family left. I was going to another family, but I had a month off. And I was living with this gentleman, basically as a kept woman. And I would lay out all day and party all night. And I was drinking to do everything. I had to drink to take a shower, to blow dry my hair. I couldn't accomplish anything without drinking. And eventually I started sleeping with people for money. And that's really kind of the lowest, some of the lowest parts of my drinking. And I was listening to a tape on the way over here of Johnny H. from California on the traditions. And he was talking about the seventh tradition and being self-supporting of our own contributions. And I had no concept of this. I was leading a really parasitical existence. And I would say, I mean, I was working as a nanny, but there was still so much of that that was so parasitical for me. And when I got sober, my sponsor told me I had to get a real job because nannies don't stay sober, he said. But I just this idea that he said, whoever pays the piper calls the tune. That's what Johnny H. was saying. And I really started to think about that with my drinking, because that's what was happening for me. I was handing over my self-respect and my myself, my body, my self-esteem, my conscience to anyone who had the most money, you know. And there came a day when I was sober when I realized that I had paid for everything that I was wearing that day, down to my underwear. And it was one of the greatest days of my sobriety. I mean, it wouldn't mean much to anybody else, but it meant a lot to me, because it finally meant that I was taking responsibility for my life. And my first job, I mean, I was crazy when I got sober. I could not think clearly. In fact, I think I lost my cognizance even more after I got sober than before I got sober. In fact, I was a receptionist, and I couldn't barely transfer a phone call. If someone said their name and their company, then I was, you know, I was constantly transferring them to the wrong people, and I wasn't making very much money. I had $13 every 2 weeks for food. And I was, but I was self-supporting of my own contributions. And it really was the beginning of me becoming a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful for my sponsor. My first sponsor I had for 2 years was a man, Frank B. I think he came out to speak here. And then I got a woman sponsor. And he and his wife and just the program of Alcoholics Anonymous totally carried me and totally took care of me, because I was really incapable of doing basic life things. And how I got here, I had been seeing this shrink, and she basically said to me, she was a counselor, and she was in AA. I didn't really get it at first what that meant. I didn't get that she relapsed while she was seeing me. I didn't get that either. But eventually, and she was borrowing my clothes, my nightclub clothes, to spice up her marriage. But eventually she said to me, you know what, Linda, I don't want to hear it from you anymore. I'm tired of your story. It's the same thing every week. And you're going to wind up dead in the Georgetown River. Go write a Danielle Steele novel. And I'm not going to see you anymore unless you get some help. And you need a support group. And I really hadn't talked to her much about my drinking. I mean, I guess I had been telling her what was going on, but I hadn't been telling her, like, oh, this is a problem. I had been complaining about other things, like my eating or how I felt about myself. And she said, OA is, you know, it's ridiculous. It's not good. You need to go to AA. And I thought, okay, whatever. You know, I'm not an alcoholic, but sure, I'll go for the support, whatever. And I just put it in my calendar. I was so delusional. I had no idea. I had no idea the reality of the life that I was living. And I had deceived myself into such a way, because when I went to work for this new nanny family, this woman was she was a very high-powered woman in D.C., and was not going to have a hungover nanny coming up every morning to take care of her children. There was no way. And she let me know that the first week. She didn't even address my drinking. She just addressed my behavior. Like, who did I hire? You are not the person I thought I hired. And I shaped up really quick. And I stopped drinking during the week. I only drank on the weekends. And so I had this delusion that I didn't have a problem because I was cleaning up my act. And I was going back to school, and I was getting straight A's at this time because I wasn't drinking during the week. But at the same time, I was still at night, you know, doing those same behaviors that I was when I was drinking. I was still taking money from men. I was involved in a relationship with a man who was in a multi-million-dollar lawsuit with my boss. And so I was leading these triple lives, but deluding myself that I was really honest, because all I knew was cash register honesty. I wasn't stealing from you. I wasn't taking your money. Money was the only way I could measure things. I thought money fixed everything, you know? And when I got to AA, I really thought I was an honest person, but it was quite a shock to me when I realized the reality of my true nature. But so when I was told to go to this AA meeting, I thought, well, I don't have a problem with drinking. But I did know deep inside that I had a problem. There was a problem. There was something really wrong with me. I didn't think it was drinking, but I thought I had some kind of mental problem. But so I just did what she said, and I certainly wanted to keep seeing her. And at the same time, I was crazy. I made an appointment in my book to go to AA, and the night before I went out and got drunk, and the next day I made an appointment to get prayed for by a church. And so I went to church, and then I went to this AA meeting, and a friend of mine today, Mike H. from our group, was leading this meeting at a club, and he said, what are you doing tonight? And I said, nothing. And he said, well, someone's going to come and get you for a meeting. And I went home, and within 2 hours, Barbara D. from our home group called me. And, I mean, at the time, I thought, ugh, people are calling, you know, like somebody's, you know, because I'm so bad with being with people. But when I look back now, I think about the program of AA and the network of how fast someone got to me, how fast someone got to the newcomer. I'm astounded, and I'm so grateful. And I actually, she didn't pick me up, but I met her at the meeting. And I'll never forget, she shared, I shared about how, you know, oh, I'm in a hard place, and we all must be in a hard place, or we wouldn't be in this AA meeting together, and, you know, how horrible things are. And she shared, you know what? I'm not in a hard place. I have a great life, and I am really happy today, and my life is nothing like it was. And she was sharing this message of hope and how AA works. And all I could think was, she is putting me down. She is trying to make me look bad. Look at her talking back to me, you know. And now she's one of my best friends and has saved my life multiple times in AA, you know. And I'm so grateful for her. But it just is amazing how we my mind can twist the positive into the negative in just a split second because my ego is so big and so sensitive, you know. And I have been going to meetings ever since that day. I was sober about a month and a half, and I relapsed on one of those pills that said take as needed for anxiety. And my sponsor said, well, new date, you know, and I had friends and family who were like, that's unfair, you've been ripped off, and we're going to count your sobriety date from before that, and I was like, no, you know, and today I would never think twice about that, and it really wasn't an issue for me even, I knew for myself, but it was just interesting to hear those other voices that from people that don't understand because the medical community is so strong. That if a doctor says you can take it, then it must be okay, you know, and it's a really big trap. And I've been going, since that date of August 14th, 1996, I've been sober ever since. I've been going to meetings, and that group has carried me, and I feel so lucky to be, I mean, I was a loner and an isolator, someone who would drink before she went to parties because she couldn't face the crowd. And I'm in a home group of like 250 people. And I feel like it was a cosmic joke from God because he really made me like face all of my fears right away. I mean, at first when people would talk to me, it was painful. I mean, it was physically painful for me to get out of myself enough to actually have a conversation with somebody else. And people would say, wait right here, we're going to be right back. And I would get in my car and drive away. And I have to really remember that today when I'm working with newcomers because I sometimes can get very judgmental. I hate to say that, but it's true. And it's like, well, they must not really want it. Or if they really wanted that help. And I have to say, wait a minute. Think about how you were when you were new. And you couldn't, you could barely, you know, stay there or stay in your seat or keep from not shaking. And how people always welcomed you back without judgment, you know. And I was so lucky for that, just so lucky for that, that I have come from a home group that is so big in helping the newcomer and sponsorship and is very strong tradition in those areas. And my sponsor just, I was like this lost sheep. And he and his wife just were like new parents to me. When I had no money, he would feed me. In fact, he made me get a second job at night working with him for no money. I don't really know how that all happened, but I would work in D.C. and then drive to Rockville at night and work at this rehab center with him, basic for in health insurance, even though I already had health insurance. I don't know. It was kind of a conspiracy so people could just watch me because they were afraid that I would go out and just, they never knew where I was going to be or if I was going to show up from day to day or week to week. And I had an awful, awful attitude. And I would just bring it there every day. And I'm really grateful for that now, because it turns out, you know, you never know what's being asked of you, how God's going to use what's being asked of you. It turns out that I was able to use that time that I spent working at that facility, just part of my requirements to go to graduate school today. And God takes care of you. You just never know. Even the thing that's in front of you right now, for me, that I hate and I'm dreading and I can't take, somehow that's going to be gold at some point in my life. And that's been my experience throughout. And coming to AA meetings, and I found that there was never a problem that I had. And this is how, for me, the second and third step really evolved for me. It was through that educational variety of coming to meetings and knowing that no matter what problem I had, there was always someone in this room that had experience with that, that had been down that road before and could share that with me. And I could never be different. I could never say, well, you don't understand. And I really felt like, at first, my sponsor was probably my higher power, because I used to think that just sitting next to him in a meeting, I felt like, or just getting into a meeting, you know, and eventually it had to evolve to that place where at 4 a.m. when you're all by yourself, you know, there you have something with you. And people would say, pray, just keep praying, because I would say, I don't feel anything. I grew up in a really Christian home, and I must have asked Jesus to be my Savior 100 times, because I didn't feel anything when I was praying, you know. And this is not, I mean, this is not a, AA is not a Christian organization, but that is just an example. And my higher power today, which I choose to call God, they just said, keep praying, and I would get on my knees and pray and pray, and I would feel nothing. And then, I hate to say that it took getting dumped by this guy that pushed me to a whole level, new level of spirituality in AA. But he left me for this woman he said he was going to marry. She was tall and thin and well-built, and she had like 16 years of sobriety. And I thought, there's nothing on this level I can compete with. And thank God for that, because I had no delusion, no distraction that I should be competing in Alcoholics Anonymous about anything, that there is any type of competition on a spiritual plane in any way. And I was really broken, and that shows you the level of my spirituality, that it took that to get me there. But I started praying, and then one day I knew. I just felt it. I mean, I hate to say it was a feeling, but it was like this understanding inside of me where I knew there was something bigger than me looking out for me, that had kept me safe through all my drinking, that had provided me venues and help throughout my whole life and protected me when I should have been dead. And that was the beginning of that relationship for me with a higher power, and with the able to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him, and to work the rest of the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is basically for me the best breakdown of step 3, is to go on with the program and to do my 4th step and my 5th step, which did not seem like a big deal to me at first. When my first 4th step, it just was, my sponsor said, it'll take you 3 hours, just do it. And I did it, and I said it, and at the time I had no real connection to the stuff that was on the paper. But eventually, over time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've grown to become very connected to this, to that patterns and those defects and the harm I had done to other people. And I was able to, especially with my family, with the children that I took care of, those families that I nannied for, that boyfriend that I ruined his campaign, not single-handedly, but, you know, with many, many people in before and after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was thinking recently, when I was thinking about the sixth and seventh step, and my sponsor always says to me for the sixth step, you know, just cut it out. That's the cut it out step, you know, which is easier said than done. But I can change my actions. I can take, you know, I can stop lying, or I can stop stealing, I can stop my actions, but I may not be able to stop my thinking. And sometimes I eventually can learn how to do a better job of not getting as far into my defect or into that root of my thinking, the spiral. But I really need God to change me with that. And I had an experience recently with my husband. We had a disagreement about having a baby, and which I really wanted to have, and which he doesn't want to have, and which is fine. But I didn't think it was fine. It's not like I'm not sad that I'm having a baby, but I really saw the connection between the sixth and seventh step and the third and the first three steps, I guess, because all of my character defects came out, and I went into this tunnel for about 3 days that I didn't know if I could come out of. And luckily, during those 3 days, I had been asked to leave like 3 meetings and have all these commitments. So I showed up with a smile in all these places, and it was like, wow, this program really works, you know. And my sponsor would just say, you know, this is going to all work out. And my defects were just raging, just my resentments and my judgments and my self-righteousness and my expectations and all kinds of things. And eventually, I had to really go back to the third step, you know. And am I really thinking that God is in control here? That am I really turning my will and my life over to the care of a higher power? I don't know if this is a very good example, but it seems to have been ruling my life lately, so I'm just using it. It really brought me right back to that place of who is in control? Who can help me with the defects that I'm in right now? And am I willing to let go of this and say that my will is aligned with God's will? And if I don't have a baby, then that must be the best, most fulfilling life for me, because that's it. Because that's what I have the husband that I believe I'm supposed to have. And if we're not supposed to have children, then I have to be okay with that. And not that that's okay like that, but, you know, my intention has to be, and I have to be willing to turn my care of my life over, because I need something to restore me to sanity, because I am powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. So if I believe that I'm an alcoholic, then I have no choice really, because I must turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And as, you know, as I understand him. And, you know, since I've been sober, I've had some amazing gifts in my life, just amazing gifts. And, I was able to graduate from college. It took me 17 years, but I did it. And it was the first time I saw my father cry, I think. And now I'm getting my master's in acupuncture, and it's wonderful. And actually, you know, I've been able to travel. I got married to a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got proposed to in under the Eiffel Tower. I got married in Florence, Italy. You know, I'm living, it's like a dream. And I'm a person who was taking money in Alexandria and degrading herself. And now I can have a relationship that's real with after what I've learned how to be a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is just amazing. It's so beautiful. And But beyond those things, you know, I have a nice place to live, and actually my husband is supporting me today, which I thought would never happen again. I had a lot of feelings about that because I was working. I work now. I don't take money from anybody, and I have my money, and don't come near me, you know. And but it's not the same thing as it was before. And more than that, I think in the eighth step and the ninth step, I've just had some incredibly healing experiences with my family. You know, and I had easy ninth step amends and not so easy. Ones that I thought were going to be easy, I thought, no problem, not so great. That family that I first nannied for, I was really afraid to call, and they were just like, we're really happy for you. We're really happy. If you ever want to come to New York and go into the city, you can stay with us. Bring your friends. And then that boyfriend, he was just like, that's great. Just stay away from me and my family, you know, which is fine, which no doubt is necessary. And there's probably a whole, you know, I asked my sponsor this week if I need to make amends to the Democratic Party. And she just said, just vote, okay? Just don't cause any trouble. And I think, okay. And, my family is probably the one that got the brunt of it. And I didn't really think they got it because they didn't see me drinking. They were in Pennsylvania. I did all my drinking here. But there were times I showed up home drunk or, with incidents that were just horrible to put my parents through. I mean, my mother is so religious. She's just such a devout person. And just to see her daughter behaving the way I behaved and going through the mental turmoil was just so tragic for them. And for me to be in a mental hospital because she really couldn't handle that. She kind of went a little nuts. And I left my sisters in this chaos, you know. And they loved me. That was their older sister. I was like 8 and 10 years older than them. So I was really like my older sister. And I left them in some chaos, you know, and they really hated me, and they felt guilty for it. You know, that's such a horrible thing, to cause someone to be angry with you and for them to feel so guilty about being angry with you when they have every right to be angry with you. And it has taken a really long time, even though they say, oh, it's fine. You know, those amends, it seemed so easy. I would sit down with my parents or my sisters and be like, you know, I'm making amends, or what can I do? Oh, we're just glad you're happy. We're just glad you're here. Just be part of our life. But the trust and the belief that you're really going to show up when you say you're going to show up, it just takes so much longer, you know, and I really, with my sisters, it's really become so great that I've been able to take care of my one sister. Has 4 children. She trusts me with her children. My other sister, my youngest sister, probably the hardest relationship. We were the least close. And a year and a half ago, her fiancé died. She just came home one night and he was dead on the couch. It was really tragic. She had just mailed her save the dates. And I was with her a lot, and she started calling me and asking for my support. And I hate that it took that for our relationship to solidify, but I thought in my heart, I was like, I'm going to be a sister here. I mean, I'm going to show this. My sister needs me, and I just was like there. And I don't want a medal for doing what you should do, but it really was the beginning of a relationship that's just starting for us. And that was like 8 and a half years of sobriety. It took that long. And just this past July, my father and I, it's probably the most painful relationship that I have. My father is just the nicest guy. He is a straight arrow, old-fashioned guy who'd do anything for his family. You know, you just sacrifice for your family. That's what you do. And his daughters are like the apple of his eye. And I just had so much guilt and so much junk between for me. And I was showing up. I had made amends. I was showing up and doing all those things. But it was still so painful for me. I had all these weird feelings around having to, wanting to take care of him and support him because he spent all this money on me and I wasted it with college. And there were years where my father and I never spoke to each other. Till finally I ended up in a mental hospital and he looked at me and said, "This is not my daughter. I don't know who this is, but this is not my daughter." And I said, "Don't you ever think you know who I am?" You know, which those words may not be cursing or horribly directed words, but they just can cut to the heart of a person. And my dad wanted nothing but the best for his family. And over the years, we've been spending more time together and a little bit at a time. He always wants other people with us. We were never alone. And we could talk maybe 5 minutes on the phone. We never really had conversations. And this year, we really started talking more. And in July, I spent an unprecedented hour and a half alone with my father. And I learned more about him in that hour and a half than I had no idea about this man. You know, I thought, I mean, we didn't never see eye to eye on anything with political, social, you know, very different. And but I have great admiration for him. And I had no idea, you know, his favorite movies. I could never have guessed, you know, that he loved Wuthering Heights or Shane or watched the news in different languages to get a different perspective on the world, you know. And I just had no idea, and it was so wonderful. And then that night he said, "Hey, Lynn, do you want to come out and sit with me outside and just talk?" And I thought, oh, my God, you know. And I felt like all of that guilt, all of that improper responsibility, all of that, it just like was like lifted from me. And I just felt like, here we are, human being, worker among workers, two people just interacting and really loving each other. And then he started calling me. And we started having long conversations on the phone. And I was so grateful for this program. And that's one of the greatest gifts I could ever imagine. You know, my dad doesn't like to talk on the phone. In fact, you'll be talking to him and he'll just say, "Okay, I'm done." And then hang up the phone. Like, that's it. And the other day he said to me, we were talking and he said, "Okay, I'm done." And then he goes, "Oh, wait a minute. He goes, "That was okay, right? You were done talking, right?" And came back. And I was like, okay, you know. And it was just, that is one of the greatest gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I don't have much time, but certainly working with new people and carrying this message and practicing this, the principles of this program in all of my affairs, you know, and probably doing that with my family is the hardest, or at home with my husband is the hardest, and we're places where it should be the easiest, you know, and I'm very quick to judge, I'm very quick to say, you've blown your chance with me, you know, and so in AA, we don't get to say that, you know. And that's the greatest thing, because when I was new, I was stepping on people's toes, burning bridges, and people always said, "Keep coming back, keep coming back. I'm going to help you, even though you're destroying my best friend's relationship," you know, whatever. And that is the message for me, for the newcomer, is if you come and you screw up, don't ever think you've done it. You can't come back to AA, because this is where we belong, the screw-ups, you know. I mean, if I had to get good and come to AA, I would have never made it here. And, you know, I'm so grateful for this program, for my sponsor, for all the people who have helped me, for everyone who's here tonight, because without y'all, I would be, who knows where I would be. I'd either be dead or in a mental hospital or tormented, but I certainly would not be useful. I would certainly not be a productive member of society. And that's what God wants for me, to be happy, joyous, and free, and to be useful servant to Him. So thanks for letting me share.